Last time in our studies in the book of Genesis, we were considering that sad episode in Lot's life. It's the concluding part of the story of Lot, in fact, as far as the Old Testament scriptures go. He doesn't appear again in the book of Genesis, in the remainder of the account of Abraham's life. His nephew never seems to cross paths with him again. It's a story of love for the world rather than love for God, even in the heart and soul of one who had faith in God. He demonstrated that the world attracted him. The world clung to him, and he could not let go of it happily. It's a sobering story. It's a challenging story for every one of us. And I guess, you know, we can come away from the end of that chapter and think to ourselves, well, Job, despite his faith in God, by which he's accounted righteous, the only explanation for the Apostle Peter's declaration of Job, of Lot's righteousness, rather, not Job, Lot. Despite that, he was a despicable man. I mean, you just read that 19th chapter and the things that he said and the things that he did and the offers that he made. I mean, what person in their right mind would do such things and say such things and negotiate such deals? I'm in no danger of that kind of behaviour. It's the Apostle Paul who says, if anyone thinks he stand, let him take heed lest he fall. I wonder what Abraham thought as the morning after he had interceded for Sodom and Gomorrah, when he went out to that point in the mountains from which the valley could be seen, and there witnessed the smoke rising from the destroyed cities of the valley. I wonder what went through Abram's mind. So, not even 10, I suppose. Not even 10 righteous. What happened to Lot? Was he saved? His wife? His daughters? Oh, I think, weren't they engaged? What about the sons-in-law? What happened to them? I wonder. Perhaps such thoughts went through his mind, and perhaps there was a thought of thankfulness. I'm glad I wasn't there. I'm glad I didn't make that choice. I'm glad I'm happy with a semi-nomadic lifestyle, and I haven't fallen in love with the world like my foolish nephew Lot. And so perhaps with such thoughts in his mind, Abram journeys from Mamre with all its sad memories and heads to the south. Perhaps the reason for his move is because of pasturing his substantial livestock flocks and herds. We're not told what motivated him, but there he goes then, this nomad of the wilderness with his family and his flocks. And he settles there in Gerar. And the story unfolds with a kind of deja vu feeling about it. We've been here before. Hasn't Abraham Hasn't Moses already written this? Isn't he getting a bit confused, perhaps, in his old age, getting on for 120 now? No. No, you see, we have seen this before. Different place, same story, more or less. 12th chapter of this book has recounted for us their journey into Egypt, fleeing from famine. And the same statements being made. Abram saying his beautiful 90-year-old wife is his sister. She acknowledging him as her brother. Because even now, even at this extended age, she is a desirable woman. Her looks, possibly. Her brother's wealth, probably. Whatever it was, there was fear in their hearts concerning their safety as they travel. It has become a habit for them, despite the Egyptian episode, their practice ever since they left Ur of the Chaldeans. Abram is Sarah's brother. Sarah is Abram's sister. That is how they are known to all the strangers that they meet in all their wanderings, in all the places they go. Ralph Waldo Emerson, an American poet and writer, once said, "Our strength grows out of our weakness. Our strength grows out of our weakness." Another writer has said, "Your strength is your weakness." And to prove his point, he gives a number of examples. The patient person has a tendency to indecisiveness. The focused person to stubbornness. The persuasive person to manipulating others. The independent person to being perceived as unfriendly. The spontaneous person as being undisciplined. A strength can be a weakness. Okay, well, we can all acknowledge that not every example that we can think of a spontaneous person results in undiscipline and so forth. But you get the point. Your strength is, or at least can be, your weakness. Now, something along those lines is happening in the life of Abraham, I think. It's not so much that his strength is his weakness, as his strength contrasts strongly with his weakness. They're both in the same area of his life. You see, what do we think of? When you think of Abraham, what do you think of? You think of a man of faith. A man of incredible faith in God. That he would leave a culture that he knew, family that he'd grown up with, a secure situation in an advanced society of the world of his day, to follow a God he didn't know, to a place he didn't know, with the results he didn't know. But he obeyed. He followed God. He left everything that was familiar to him and went on a journey that was unfamiliar for him. The city dweller became a nomad. The heathen became a follower of the God of the covenants. We think of Abraham and his faith. The man who, year after year after year, with no child, no son, despite the promise of God, yet believed God. And it was counted to him as righteousness. Over and over and over again, the Bible presents Abraham as the man of faith, as the great example of faith, as the embodiment, as it were, of what salvation by faith is. That's his strength. That is what he is known for. And yet, as we look at his life, as we have seen already, and as Genesis chapter 20 demonstrates to us again, Abraham's faith was not unwavering. As strong as it was, as great an example of faith as he is, there are times in his life when he demonstrates incredible unbelief. He's willing to leave family and friends and culture and society and home and comforts and all of that and to follow God, to obey God, to do God, what God tells him to do. Incredible faith. And then he'll take his life into his own hands and do things his own way rather than trusting in the God the day before he trusted so implicitly. He's an amazing man of contrast, you see, in this one area of faith and faithlessness, of belief and unbelief. It isn't really that his strength has grown out of his weakness or that his strength is his weakness, but there's a relationship between these two things. Let him who stands take heed, lest he fall. And I think in part the reason for the repetition of this story from the life of Abraham is to emphasize for the reader this very fact. You see, what are the Israelites about to do? They're on the verge of heading into the promised land. They're on the verge of, at the point when Moses has finished writing this history for them and delivers it to them, they're on the verge of the Jordan preparing to enter into the land of promise. A land that is filled with fields and vineyards that they didn't plant, and cities that they didn't build, and cisterns that they didn't fill. And they're going to inherit it all. It's all going to be theirs. And they're going to be comfortable after their years of wandering. And they're going to be prosperous after their years of slavery. And they're going to live happily ever after. Or are they? Let him who stands take heed, lest he fall. It's interesting, you see, that the two episodes of Abraham's unbelief have come hot on the heels of examples of faith, of dependence upon God, of walking in God's ways, of trusting in God. He leaves Ur of the Chaldees. He goes as God commanded him on a journey he doesn't know where it will take him. And he believes God and he trusts in God. And he's promised the land where he comes to and sojourns there. And he's promised an heir and he believes God and he trusts in God. And then he heads off to Egypt and tells lies and deceives in order to save his skin. And here he's been in this amazing encounter with God. I mean, we're talking in the very immediate past. God has visited him. Yahweh has come in a theophanic vision, more than a vision. He's come in the form of a man with two angels accompanying. He's sat down with Abram. He's eaten with Abram. He's talked with Abram. He's renewed his promise with Abram. Abram has discussed the future of Sodom and Gomorrah. He's pleaded for God's mercy upon that city. All of that has just transpired. And he's seen the power of God at work against the wicked. He has witnessed the devastation of Sodom and Gomorrah. All of that has just happened. And there he goes on his way. And he tells lies. And he deceives in order to save his own skin. From a fear that is unfounded, as it turns out. Such an amazing contrast, this man of faith, this blessed man, and yet this unbelieving man. It emphasizes for the children of Israel, you are going into the promised land, the land that for centuries now has been promised to you, that God has faithfully cared for you, protected you, delivered you, brought you here. You're on the verge of entering it. Don't forget your God. Don't say, it is by the strength of my arm that I have accomplished this. Don't boast in what you receive. It is the gift of God. It is from the hand of God. He's the one who will give you the victory. He is the one who will give you these cities and these vineyards, these fields and these cisterns. Don't forget who it is that provides, protects, and redeems. And so the episode unfolds, and this claim that has been made, not baseless claim, not an untruth in and of itself, but partly the whole truth. His sister, yes, but also his wife, conveniently overlook that detail, allow her to be taken away. It happened before, and yet it's repeated itself. Faith is what Abraham is known for, and unbelief is his besetting sin. Isn't that amazing? Surely it calls us to be on our guard, doesn't it? That when we think we stand, when we think that we're not susceptible to temptation, when we think we have gained the victory over some sin, some situation, we need to be on our guard. We need to trust in God. We need to obey God. I wonder what Abram thought as he spent that first night, knowing that Sarah was off in the house of this king of Gerar. We see the incredible mercy of God unfold in this story, as we saw it before in the Egyptian episode. God comes to Abimelech. God tells Abimelech the truth of this situation. He protests his innocence. God tells him to go to Abram. And Abram will pray for him if he returns Abram's wife to him. And God declares that this man whose wife Abimelech has taken is a prophet. That's the very first time in the whole of Scripture that we see meet a prophet of God. Interesting fellow, isn't he? This prophet of God. He's a liar, a deceiver, a fearful man. Isn't it interesting the kind of people that God chooses? That God allows to be his servants to accomplish his purposes. You know, at this point, you see, Abram is not the great man of faith. Abram is the faithless man whose life is marked out for the most part by faith, but he has this besetting sin of unbelief that rears its ugly head from time to time. And it's in the midst of that kind of situation that God declares that this man is his prophet. And that this man can plead for Abimelech. And that God will hear this man. Hear his words. Hear his prayers. And free Abimelech from his condemnation. Isn't that amazing? The mercy of God both to Abimelech and to Abraham. The grace of God and the riches of God. Despite the failures of both men. Abimelech rose, told his servants, they're all fearful, they've encountered the living God. Abraham had thought there is no fear of God among this people. But when they encounter God, there is fear of God. Abraham had thought that they would not count his life as anything, that they would as quickly crush him under their foot as they would an ant and take his wife. But here is a God, here is a people and a king who understand right from wrong to some degree, and who declares to Abraham that what he has done to them is not right. And asks of him, what did you see? What did you think that you should do this thing to us? And Abraham's lame answer comes. Didn't think there was any fear of God here. Thought you'd kill me. Well, actually, she is my sister. I wasn't telling any lies. This is our practice. This is how it's been. I've not treated you any differently from anywhere, any other king of any other city in any of the rest of my travels. So this is what we've done for years and years and years and years. And yet, God allows Abram to plead for Abimelech. Abram prayed. And God healed him and healed his family and his slaves. It would appear that the way in which God had protected Sarah from being violated was through a sickness inflicted upon Abimelech and his family that prevented the consummation of the marriage, if there was a marriage as such that had taken place between Abimelech and Sarah. God says that I have kept you from sinning against me. I did not let you touch her. And when Abram prayed to God, God healed Abimelech and healed his wife and their female slaves so that they bore children. The Lord had closed their wombs and the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abram's wife. So there was something that God did that prevented Sarah from being fully taken by this man. God hears the prayers of Abram. The man is healed. His wife is healed. His slaves are healed. And Abram has learned a lesson. We never hear again of Abram making these claims concerning Sarah. It's taken time, it's taken years, and it's taken two episodes in which Sarah has been taken into the home and almost into the bed of another man, where Abram has been in fear of his life. And eventually the message seems to get through to Abraham that this kind of behaviour is not honouring to God, that this kind of behaviour is a demonstration of unbelief rather than faith, which is the hallmark of Abraham's life otherwise. God doesn't give up on us, does he? And we, like Abraham, stumble and fall in the same way over and over and over again. And God is merciful and kind to us. He picks up the pieces of the mess that we make, and he makes it right again. He heals, and he restores, and he blesses. But lessons need to be learned. We don't live our lives. Well, actually, I have heard some Christians live in this way, but we ought not to. Well, it's okay. God will forgive me. I'll give in this once more and ask for God's mercy afterwards. And he'll restore, because he's a God of love and he's a patient God. Such reasoning is far from healthy for any follower of Jesus Christ. It demonstrates a lack of understanding of the cost of our salvation, the sufferings that Jesus Christ endured to pay the penalty for that sin that we can so easily dismiss. Oh, God will forgive me. How will he forgive? With the pouring out of the cup of the wrath of God upon our Saviour Jesus. Forgiveness costs. It costs. And we need to appreciate that sin is never good, and it's never something that we can dismiss lightly and easily, and it's never something that we can reason in our own minds, God will forgive me, it'll all be okay. We need to learn from our errors, from our flaws, as Abram did. To learn to overcome whatever the weakness is that is our particular weakness. To put it to death, to use the language of the Apostle Paul. To mortify it, to have it buried in the grave, and never allowed to raise its ugly head again. We need to move on from habits of behaviour. These habits that have been a mark of Abraham's life, though we only see two episodes where the habit has produced a situation of terrible stress and anguish and uncertainty. But this deception has been the habit of Abram's life, and he's had to learn to break it, and God has had to take him through these situations in order to bring to Abraham's attention the seriousness of his unbelief at times, so that he will not walk around with his head held high saying, "Oh, well, last week only I was speaking with Yahweh. I had dinner with him. He's a good friend of mine." If it could happen to Abraham, it can happen to you. It can happen to me. We can have an encounter with the living God that thrills our souls and has, as it were, lifted us into the seventh heaven. And we can fall like a rock into the deepest ocean of depression and sin. That is not the way to live our lives, brothers and sisters. God is a God of mercy. God is the God of grace. And what this episode teaches us is that God is a God who is to be trusted under any and every circumstance. He is the one that we go to when we're in fear of our lives. Not to our own resources and ingenuity, or the habits that have worked well for us in the past. We trust in Him and we obey His word. And then we will see Him act on our behalf in happier ways than this episode in Abraham's life. And as we will see in the next study in this book of Genesis, as happened before, after Abraham's fall and after the second manifestation of this flaw in Abraham's life, God brings blessing, God brings assurance, God encourages and strengthens the faith of this man who loves Him, who serves Him, and He does the same for us because He is a merciful God and He is one in whom we can put our trust.